This is the real weepy and like tragic part of the story beginning, oh my brothers and only friends.
I'm in for four potential getaway drivers. Go.
No!
But I was told that I could listen to the radio at a reasonable volume.
No!
Excuse me, we have a little bit of a hurry.
Hang on, Voltaire.
It's yet another long series of diversions in an attempt to avoid responsibility.
Oh, wow! Chuck up yet another week-long hiatus in an ever-expanding repertoire of podcasting absences to this just in. Last week pretty much had nothing of value, except maybe the inherently funny yet tragic news that our vice president shot a man in the face with a shotgun and will not, I repeat, not be put in jail for manslaughter, while the American public somehow complacently lets this administration slide further into Emperor Palpatine-esque political maneuvers whose end result will surely be the apocalypse. To allay your fears, however, consider this just in your bunker while Armageddon rages on. Your solitude while the frigid nuclear winter wipes the earth into a tabula rasa, free of assholes like Dick Cheney, who will surely be gnashing his teeth and biting off his tongue in the hottest of hells. As few podcasting from Detroit.
I'm Tanner Higgin, podcasting from Los Angeles.
And today is a perfect day to share recipes, read listener mail, discuss what it takes to grade papers, and maybe even talk about feminism and how much we want to make love to it. Let's start simple. Let's start simple with something that I love, and that's food. I've been cooking for many years, and I love to make dishes that titillate or excite my palate. As of late, I'm finding myself looking for the perfect recipes so I can consistently have wonderful meals to look forward to each week. Or, you know, when I come home, I like to come home and start whipping up a dinner for myself. And I thought it'd be interesting if Tanner and I shared some of our favorite recipes this week, and that maybe if you guys have your own recipes, I would be glad to steal any of them from you. So you can email your favorite recipes to chris@the-means.com. I'll whip them up and maybe even discuss some of the best ones on here. But we'll start with you, Tanner. What recipe would you like to reveal to the audience that might tickle their taste buds?
First, I want to discuss the fact that it is a myth that cooking for yourself is cheaper than going out to eat. Because since I finally moved out and began cooking for myself, I've begun to realize how fucking expensive it is to go to the supermarket every week. I mean, it just kills me. And I always thought that there'd be no way that shopping for yourself would be as expensive as going out to eat. But I really do think that it's truly more expensive to cook for yourself. However, I think that the difference is made up in the fact that it can be fun and that, you know, you're not going to become massive from eating out and, you know, God knows how many calories are in everything you eat when you go out to eat nowadays, especially considering portions now have to, at any chain restaurant, like an Outback Steakhouse, portions are made for like a family of grizzly bears rather than human beings. But what I mainly cook nowadays is I hardly eat any beef anymore for just, I guess, personal preference. Not some political stand or anything. It's just I'm sort of sick of beef. So I eat mainly fish, and what I've been noticing that's really awesome is whipping up a really quick marinade in the early afternoon, throwing some fish into the marinade, let it marinate for, you know, a couple hours, 2-3 hours, and then throwing it on a charcoal grill. And that has become amazing. And my standby marinade has been a good base of olive oil. Then you throw in maybe a tablespoon of soy sauce, some teaspoons of fresh lemon juice, salt, you know, pepper, and then maybe some freshly ground garlic. Mix that up, throw that in with the fish, let it marinate, and just throw it on the grill, and bam, you're done. And you maybe have a vegetable on the side and some rice. And it's easy, it's pretty cheap, and it always tastes really good. And it gives the fish like a great flavor throughout. And a lot of times even makes it a little bit more juicy, which is awesome. And combine that with the charcoal grill, which is just dominant, absolutely dominant, even though it's a lot of work. You get a really flavorful meal, really quick and easy, with ingredients you almost always have on hand.
Well, let me tell you, Tanner, that your choice really pisses me off, and it's because you brought up the word grilling, and that's that's seasonal here in Michigan. I'm not even putting something on a grill. Right now, it's -5 degrees outside, and the wind is blowing at, like, miles per hour. There's no way in hell, unless I had a parka, some snowshoes, and maybe a few Huskies to carry my sleigh out to my grill, maybe I'd then consider that.
I didn't even consider that, yeah.
But right now, everything that we cook here in Michigan, unless you're a badass, is cooked inside. But I'm glad that you did bring it up, because grilling is, contrary to what some people would say, people want to denounce grilling as just being, oh, it's a man's thing, and it's not really cooking, but there is an art form to cooking on the grill, and so, you know, when summer comes around, I'll be able to add more to this, but I have my own marinades that I make for, but, and I haven't cut beef out of my diet, so my marinades do go on to, they go with steaks, usually. In terms of my selection for my recipe, it's a recipe I found called Singapore Spicy Noodles, and I had had them, they weren't called Singapore Spicy Noodles, but I had them in a restaurant, and I kind of was searching Google based on the flavors that I tasted in the noodles, and I found something that was pretty much the exact replica of what I ate, and basically what you do is you get linguine noodles, and then you boil those in the water, and you drain those out, and then the interesting thing is the sauce that you make. It's so easy. It takes very little amount of ingredients, but the flavor that comes out of it is just intense. So basically what you do is, while your noodles are boiling, you take a medium saucepan, you put some water in it, just like a 1 1/4 cups, I think the recipe says. And then you take water, ketchup, sugar, cornstarch, cilantro, and then there's some seasonings. You take, like, seasoned salt, crushed red pepper, and the sugar. I'm sorry, the sugar is brown sugar. I forgot to mention that. So anyway, you take all these things, and you bring it to a boil. Then you reduce the heat, and then you put in chunky peanut butter, and you stir it around so that now the consistency of it is a little bit thicker, but it's still it's a very watery, you still have a very watery substance that you're going to throw over the noodles, and the noodles basically absorb this, and just, they get coated with it, and barely any of it, like, lingers to the bottom. You don't need to drain the noodles after you've done this, and you just serve it out of the pot onto the plate, and if you want to have a heartier meal, you can always add chicken or pork or beef or shrimp, whatever you want to do. It's a quick meal, but it's got so much flavor to it, and I've made this for my roommate, his girlfriend, a few good friends of mine, and they all fall in love with it. So, and in fact, you had it. Do you remember that time we had that Kung Fu movie marathon? Yeah, I made them that time, too.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I remember it, yeah.
Yeah, and I just love it. It's such a simple recipe, and you can throw a side of rice or something, too, with it. I mean, it's not a big deal. I don't know if you want to put rice. I rarely do, but, you know, and you can put a good vegetable, maybe, You can garnish it with cabbage and get a vegetable that way, or you can just put some fucking green beans in the microwave. Who cares?
What the hell does cornstarch do, though? Seriously,
I have no idea, and I'm not going to challenge whoever's decision it was to put it in there. Honestly, I don't know if cornstarch's final effect is a slight thickening of it.
Yeah, that's what I would imagine.
I really don't know. I mean, it's not like we're baking a cake here. I really don't know what it would do to a watery sauce, but
it's funny how there's these.
I just know it makes it taste good.
It's funny how there's these ingredients where you just throw them in there. You have no idea what their function is, and that's kind of why I like that Good Eats show on Food Network. Because he sort of takes, like, a scientific look at food, and he'll explain you, like, breaking it down to the chemical, molecular functions of every food, you know?
Wow.
And that, it sort of makes things make sense, but I've never seen a Good Eats episode on cornstarch, so I've never used it, but I imagine it's got to be a thickening agent.
I can say, honestly, that I've never used cornstarch in anything else that I cook. maybe it's the key ingredient. It could be the key ingredient to most recipes. I challenge anyone to put in a teaspoon of cornstarch in your next recipe, even if it never called for it, and see what happens. See if it fucks it up or if it makes it extra delicious.
Yeah, in your cereals, you know.
Put it in your hot chocolate, whatever.
I just looked it up really quick. I guess it is a thickening agent, is essentially its duty.
Thickens. Okay, so we were right.
Yeah.
Maybe we can share some more. I know you wrote a really good post probably a year ago that had your favorite recipe of yours for a sandwich, and sandwiches can certainly be a recipe in itself, so I don't know if you remember that one, but you had made a really good sandwich. And
yeah, and I started a topic on the blog, and I never even posted another recipe.
Oh. Well, we'll start that up again, because I'm going to the supermarket to buy your ingredients. It just sucks when you don't have it all at your house, because you have to start from scratch, and there is no, like, single man serving of you know, salt or something. You know, it's, you always got to buy the big ass container, and
I mean
salt's a minor thing, you know, it's $1.89 or whatever for like 2-3 big ass things of it. But when it comes to these things like, you know, ginger, or, you know, you'll find a recipe that just has ginger in it and you don't have any of that shit at your house, but you got to buy a $3.89 bottle of ginger that you'll never use.
I wish supermarkets, in order to compete with, I mean, obviously people are increasingly more going out to eat, I wish supermarkets or the food industry would compete with that by lowering prices. But it just doesn't seem like prices are all that low at the supermarket. I mean, when we go every week, it just seems like we're spending way more money than we anticipate. But, you know,
I know
it's better than going out to eat. It really is, but still it hurts.
It's way better, but, you know, and the problem is I went to the supermarket. I was cooking a meal for some friends of mine, four people we were going to eat. I spent $50 to make that meal.
Yeah, easily.
And it's like, you know, because I needed a few ingredients that were cheap, but a lot of ingredients that ended up costing me because I didn't have it available for me. So I was forced into buying things that were $4, and I wasn't even going to use an eighth of what they had in that bottle.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, now I've kind of got them on hand for the next time, but at the same time, you know, there's other ingredients I bought that were expended during the making of it. So now I've got to go rebuy those if I'm going to make that. You know, it's a shitty trade-off. I hope that, I think you're right, they should be competing with fast food, because it's a lot easier for me to go to Jimmy John's for like $3.89 for a sub,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, and call that a meal, than pay $50 for making a dish that, you know, will fill me and four friends up for one night.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, submit your recipes to chris@the-means.com, and I'll cook them, and I'll let people know what I think of them. And I'm not afraid to say that they might taste like bullshit, so. See, the next topic was, you just brought this up before we started this. It has something to do with Donald Rumsfeld not using email?
On Dig.com, one of the best sites on the internet, which, I mean, if you've been listening to this podcast, you better be going to Dig.com. They have one of their top stories this week was on a very interesting story from MSNBC Newsweek Politics by Mark Hosenball. And he was talking about how in the aftermath of Katrina, you know, where they're investigating how in the hell this administration could have been so inept at handling that situation, one of the things that's been uncovered in the investigation is that both Donald Rumsfeld and Michael Chertoff, the Secretary of Homeland Security or whatever, both of them do not use email whatsoever. And it's kind of started this debate about, is that acceptable, isn't it acceptable? They've been defending themselves saying, you know, we can get by simply through their own little networks they create, which are essentially the telephone, of course. And then they surround themselves with a bunch of different aides and communication specialists who sort of relay information between themselves. I'm assured that they're doing this through email and whatnot. And then they communicate it to both Rumsfeld and Chertoff through briefings and such. And they're basically defending themselves, saying they get by regardless. But it does beg the question, though. Like, I mean, isn't email sort of just an essential tool now to get by? I mean, can you really get by effectively without email?
No.
You say no?
I know all the answers to those questions, and I was correct in both of them. I think to say that this administration is clueless, I think is very accurate, because they this is such a key. Their hatred of, like, technology, their hatred of things that advance human beings, it's so ingrained in them that they, like, they want to be those cowboys who are like, you know what, fuck it, we ain't using any of the natural conventions that we made. You know, all they want to do is look like they're super badasses and, like, manly men who, I don't need email, I don't need to do that, I don't need that in my life. And it's bullshit, because email is pretty much communication right now. And if something needs to be passed to Rumsfeld, and let's say I'm a high-up guy, I need to get information to Rumsfeld, now it's very bureaucratic, because I have to go to an aide who's going to read the email and then has to print it out or memorize or, you know, try and summarize what it is I wrote just so that Donald Rumsfeld can be a dick and not read email?
Like, yeah,
it's stupid.
Plus, those aides have a salary, You know, they're getting paid for their time. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe they're even getting hired just to deal with this extra bureaucracy that's created by their lack of interest in email, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that does cost money to have this extra force just to relay messages, you know, back to these guys who refuse to get a goddamn BlackBerry and be accessible anywhere you go, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's
not to mention Michael. Oh, well, Michael Chertoff. Go ahead and tell yours, because mine's kind of. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the great thing about email now is that you can get it on handheld devices, and you don't need to. You can leave a message, have someone pick it up at their leisure. You know, it's not like a phone where you could be on the phone with somebody. You gotta flip off, you know, the phone and go to somebody else. It's always there. It's waiting for you. It's instant communication. You can forward messages, copy paste. I mean. It's not a fluke that email is as popular as it is. It's because it's an incredibly effective form of communication, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It baffles me. I mean, when the news came out that, like, George Bush doesn't read the newspaper and things like that, you know, it's like, this is exactly the kind of, this is the kind of thing we should be avoiding in leaders, because you need someone who is so quick to know all the little details of information. That's kind of what I want to see in people. I want them to be not only I want them to be able to be contacted within a moment's notice, and that can't happen now with I mean, it's cynicism of a public figure, and we need him. We need him to be ready. I don't get it, and their mentality pisses me off, and I think we should impeach them.
it's kind of like making the analogy that they get hired in, and, you know, they're like, okay, you know, we need to give you this cell phone. And they're like, no, I don't use cell phones. I use falcons, you know, and pigeons. And that's what I'm going to use. It's, no, that's not how it goes. You're in no position to refuse the technology that we feel is important to your job. Part of your job is understanding how to use email and using email so you can handle stuff like Katrina. If you don't want to use it, then you're gone. We'll get somebody else.
Yeah, exactly. Ugh. I hate them.
I know it's, and I think you are.
I'm tired of.
As strange as your, you know, your position might be, and I'm sure Republicans who might be listening to this podcast would criticize you and the fact that you're saying that they're cowboys and don't want to use technology as part of their gimmick. There is something right about it, though, that they're taking that position of, you know, a lot of older people are like, I don't need this. You know, this technology, mm-hmm. I got by before. It's such a ridiculous position to take when you're in such a critically important position of power in this country.
Exactly.
To refuse technology that very possibly could make you function a little bit better. And mm-hmm. if it gives you a little bit better, you know, functionality in your job, then you damn well better be using it. You're the Secretary of Defense.
Yeah. He's a horrible one at that.
Yeah, he's terrible.
I'm going to lose my job for that. But whatever. Well, speaking of email, maybe we should read some. I got an interesting email from a gentleman who, if you recall, a few weeks ago, I was talking about some dreams that I had, and I told people to email me some of their, what it is that I was experiencing with these dreams. And I have to say, also, these dreams do continue. I had, the past three nights in a row now, I've had nightmares, and they all one of them consisted of these zombie-like people who wanted to eat me, and I had to escape from them. I had to pretend I was one of them. And I was so afraid that they were going to smell me and know that I was living that they were going to eat me. But I think I put on a good game face and just pretended like I wanted to eat brains. And then last night or the night before, I can't remember, I had one that involved, I think there were like these werewolves and they wanted to eat me. And then I had to fight a gang of the Bloods or the Crips, one of those two. And then after I won against the Bloods or the Crips, whichever it was, one of them still was alive, and he threw me at a werewolf, and I had to run away from him. It was very frightening. So anyway, and these things wake me up from out of my sleep. I have people who can attest to the fact that I'm awakened by these, and I look as though I died and suddenly came back. Well, anyway, here's the email. It's from a gentleman named Seth Matterson. And he emailed me this. I'll just read it to you. He says, "Hi, Chris. I've been interested in recurring dreams and night terrors since I had them as a child. Some of the things you described seem quite similar to my experiences. Terrifying enemies, beautiful and indescribable locations, feeling the wind in my hair, the joy of bouncing off tree trunks with my feet.
I think some of that's an interesting visual. Bouncing off tree trunks with your feet.
It's like a Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Yeah, he was probably watching that movie before he went to sleep.
Well, he says the following. He says, "I think some of it has to do with a need to express unresolved trauma and have it be heard and listened to. Right now, our whole lives are created from language, a big story about who we are. In the years before we mastered our current language, we dealt only with images, unordered and often incomprehensible. We were powerless, dependent on others for our safety. Caretakers betrayed us, accidentally or on purpose, but we had no words to express it and no one to tell. I think recurring dreams and night terrors may be a communication from one's pre-language mind to present time, adult consciousness seeking safety and resolution of some kind. Dreams do their best to show where and what happened." He goes on to relate his personal experience, which I don't want to really reveal because that's up to him if that were to happen, and so I don't want to deal with that, but he goes on to say, "Also, I think the attention to dreams and memories tends to accentuate perception of a split between mind and body, possibly leading to the, quote, trapped in the body, end quote, feeling, especially combined with powerlessness, betrayal by caretakers, and physical cruelty. Anyway, he says his experience that he relates earlier in the email might not apply to my situation, but he just thinks that's after considering his own life and the types of dreams he's had, he thinks that's his explanation for shitty dreams. And I think it's an interesting, in terms of the idea of, you know, I've heard it bounced around, the idea of the unresolved trauma from when you were younger, somehow translating now when you're older, but I can honestly say, you know, I was never abused as a child, and I never really had anything traumatic. The only thing I can think about when it comes to, as I explained before, the woman in my dreams, the only thing I can think of is that I might have had some weird fear that my father would leave my mother, or I don't know what it is, because there's that... Because in that dream, the first one I ever had of her, you know, it was, I had this feeling that my dad knew this woman and that somehow there was infidelity going on. But of course, when you're 5 years old, you don't know what that is. So, honestly, I can't make a judgment on that quite. I mean, I honestly don't know. But I think he also says something really interesting when he starts talking about the whole pre-language mind to present time where we do know language and the body dealing with that. I mean, did you gather anything from that, Tan, or did you find anything?
I think he's got an interesting point just in the fact that thinking about, you know, intelligent, well, semi-intelligent beings having to operate before language, you know, mm-hmm. And what a weird period that would have been wherein the brain was evolving, you know, and they're getting smarter. But then they don't yet have language, and that weird bridge point in the development of the human, wherein you're fairly intelligent, but then you can't communicate what you're thinking, or you know, and that would be such a frustrating point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could see something where the brain would have to deal with that, you know, and dreams would be a way to deal with that. But dreams aren't cathartic to me. I think that's the problematic I see in his arguments. There's no catharsis from dreams.
Yeah, you know, I rarely have a dream where I wake up and its repercussions affect my daily life, and like I have an extra swing to my step or anything. You know, I dream something. I can dream amazing things, but when I wake up, it's not like suddenly I have a new outlook on life or anything like that. Really, it's not a cathartic experience. If anything, the good dreams I have are kind of passed along as just, oh, that, you know, that's cool, in that dream I was flying. But it's really the negative dreams that have the biggest impact on me. So any sort of catharsis, I more have an anti-catharsis. I have a breakdown because of it. Mm-hmm. I wake up and I'm trembling and I'm sweating, and that does affect my waking life. Whereas, you know, if I wake up and I just got done, maybe sometimes, like if I have those dreams where I won the lottery and I wake up and for 5 minutes I actually think I am a billionaire, you know, then that affects me for a good 10 minutes afterwards because I get pissed. Mm. Then I'm not once I realize it. But those are the only ones that really somehow carry over beyond the dream. But every negative dream I have, you know, it has a major impact on me. It's like almost like a psychosis. I don't know, that affects my day. For instance, today I was in a store and I saw a mannequin that looked like one of the zombies in my dream the other night, and I couldn't look at it. I had to turn away. I was with somebody, and I had to tell her, I was like, I can't look at that, because that looks like the zombie from my dream the other night. And it was, and that's a huge effect, though, because mannequins are everywhere, man. And what if all mannequins start looking like these zombies, and I start going crazy? I mean, it could happen. I might have to avoid, I already avoid malls, but I might have to avoid boutiques and downtown areas with mannequins in windows. It's crazy.
Do you remember, what was that movie where the mannequin comes alive?
It's called Mannequin.
Was that a horror movie?
No, not at all.
Because I can remember it being sort of frightening, almost. Didn't the guy get trapped in a department store and the mannequin comes alive and then, like, they have a romance?
Yeah, and he falls in love with her. It's horrific in itself, but...
That is horrific.
It's not a good movie.
What a plot to form a romance around something so scary. Like, who wants to fall in love with a mannequin?
If a mannequin came to life, I would punch it. And it could be the hottest, you know, wearing Victoria's Secret, you know, model mannequin. I don't care. I will dropkick that mannequin, because there's no amount of mannequin love that would sell me on, you know, it's not going to happen. Mannequins are too freaky. And then plus, if you have a relationship with one, eventually she's going to have to become a mannequin again. You know, that sucks.
Have you ever noticed, me and my girlfriend have noticed this, and how strange it is, the development of mannequins. Back in the 80s, you know, they were pretty sterile, you know, pretty, like, prototypical human without any sex or gender, at least gender attributed, but no sex attributed to it. But now, nowadays, mannequins now, nipples have become part of the accessory of a mannequin. In that they now have very defined nipples on mannequins, and it's almost like the nipple's been fetishized as part of the fashion of a woman. Have you ever noticed that and thought about that?
What I've noticed more than that, but that is an interesting point, but I can't honestly say that I've looked at a mannequin and said, wow, those nipples are incredible, and it's only adding to my lust.
Well, I'm not thinking of it in that form.
Sorry, I must have misinterpreted you. No, what I've noticed, though, is mannequins, rather than being in those poses, like in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, you know, mannequins were posing to show clothing, but now mannequins are posing with arched backs and, you know, legs cocked up a little bit.
Yeah.
It's very sexually driven. I mean, if I were perverted, I might have a fetish for this, but thankfully I'm not. You know, but there's got to be guys out there who can't even department into store without getting extremely aroused because of the way that, I mean, I guarantee you that kids in their prepubescent stages are dealing with these very weird feelings when they see mannequins, because these are very provocative mannequins. Yeah. I can't believe I'm actually saying this, by the way. This is a completely ridiculous thing to be talking about.
Well, it's not, because it shows some sort of development in the culture where, you know, I mean...
Yeah, but I'm talking about mannequin love, and that gets a little bit more weird.
What would be the acronym for mannequin love? You know, like, yeah. Manny love?
What'd you call it?
Like, Manny love? Like, I wonder if there's, like, a website dedicated to mannequin fetish.
I'm gonna check it out right now. Here we go. Let's see. Mannequin fetishes.
I'm not getting any. This is
okay, hold on. I found it. I think I found something. It's on a news... Oh, wait, here. Oh, wait, this might be better. Just bear with me, audience. I'm going to find this. Just give it to... Okay. Okay, you know how if you go to Yahoo, and they have, like, main topic areas, and you can break it down to specifics, so it starts with directory. So if you were to click directory, and then you would see society and culture. If you click that, you could go to sexuality. Then from sexuality, you'd go to fetishes and fantasies, and under that, you would finally find statues, mannequins, and dolls. There's several sites that come up that you can go to under this. The first one is called Alex the Great's Photo Manipulations, which apparently... I'm not going to go to it. I really don't want to click on any of these, I'm afraid. Then there's furry dolls, customized adult fashion dolls for the discerning collector. I don't know what that is either.
Oh, I know what that is. That's where people dress up in...
The Living Mannequin Circle.
That's where people dress up in, like, Disney type of animal suits.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's a sexual fetish related with that.
What is... Okay, the Pygmalion Syndrome Portal. Hold on, this might be it.
You know what's more...
Sexual statuophile resource site.
What disturbs me most about the potential of a mannequin fetish is the smell that the mannequin probably carries. Because I'm picturing like some 1982 mannequin from JCPenney that was like left in a dumpster and some guy like grabbed and now, you know, like has service him at home, you know, and it's and it smells like children's hands and like toilet seats and stuff.
You know what? I don't know if there is a good group online. I'm going through this and it's not really.
Yeah, it looks like somebody needs to start one up.
I think that's a good idea, and I think it'll start with you. You get to start one up. I claim. So yeah, I would like to thank Seth Matterson, whose email inspired this entire mannequin fetish diatribe. And really quickly, the other reader feedback we got, or listener feedback, was from my brother, who we knew we would piss off with our discussion of foreign cars versus domestic, and he certainly was pissed. I feel bad because I think he was a little hurt too. And so, Mike, I apologize. I didn't mean to hurt your feelings, but GM is a bunch of heartless assholes, and they would fire you in a heartbeat. So, I'm not trying to be a dick. I'm just saying that corporations don't give a fuck about me or their workers. So I'm not going to apologize for that. But I will say that he did send me some interesting articles on what the domestic automakers are trying to do to remedy the situation. Of not really being able to compete that well in the hybrid car market or just compete well in getting better fuel economy out of their cars. And it seems like they might be to improve that, but I will also say that these are, of course, monetarily driven, not driven to suit humanity. It's just driven to suit their pocketbooks. So,
and I guess the point we were trying to make is that they're only doing it now.
Yeah, exactly.
That was our point, you know.
Yeah, and I think he understood that because I told him that, and he said, yeah, I get that. So he got that, but I think he wanted to take a little bit more out of it, what we were saying, and I think he might have taken it slightly too far, because I'm not saying that I'm not going to say I'm not going to buy a GM car, but I just want them to start marketing to us. And I think he concurred with us that they aren't marketing to people like us. They're marketing to people who like gas hogs, who want to, you know, front it on the highway and look like they're fucking, you know, super badasses with their huge SUVs that get, you know, 4 miles a gallon. And that's who they're pandering to. That's who they've been pandering to for the past 7 years or so now. And it's bullshit. And they need to start looking at our demographic numbers. And certainly, even pandering to our demographic, you'll still find people who overlap and would buy the same cars we would buy. And they might not even be, you know, of the same disposition as we are when it comes to cars. But they would find a lot of people in our category. So, you know, I just wish they would start looking at us.
You know what's kind of funny is I was at a party here, and this one girl was talking about this guy she used to date out here. He had a U.S.-made pickup truck with giant wheels, you know, like those monster truck-type wheels.
Uh-huh.
And just to give an example of how much different it is out here than back at home, like back at home in Detroit and whatnot, it's very famous for having, you know, Japanese cars get defaced or keyed and that sort of thing. And out here, she said that he would always drive around in that thing, and everyone would just give them horrible, dirty looks, you know, and everyone was so annoyed by it. And cops would give him tickets when he drove around in downtown L.A. and such, because I guess you can't have a wheelbase that big or whatever and driving around the downtown since it's so narrow. And they went to the Getty Center, which is this like magnificent museum out here. And he parked it, and somebody keyed it in the Getty Center parking lot.
And, like, that is awesome.
If you go to the Getty Center, the people who go there are like, you know, academics and really high class type people and stuff. And to imagine one of them keying this car because they just find it so obnoxious. Like,
that is awesome. I just imagine all these intellectuals walking out a building like, what the fuck is this? Just get rid of this car. Oh man, I wish that would happen out here. Nobody does that. Instead, get this. Yesterday, I'm driving down I-75, and I'm going in the fast lane, and I'm going fast. All I see is headlights because it was nighttime out, and this pair of headlights is coming up behind me, and it's coming up at, like, these were fast as hell speeds, and I see a guy in the lane next to me. I can't change lanes to get out of this asshole's way because the guy next to me is going just as fast. The guy behind me cuts, almost hits me, goes in front of the guy that he apparently they were racing. I look at the car, it's a fucking Dodge Neon, alright? And this Dodge Neon is going like 150 miles per hour, if possible. The guy next to him, he's in like an Acura LX, or I don't know what those things are, some, you know, some car, and they're racing down the road. Well, we go down, and there's this curve, and this guy almost beefed it. It was like almost like leader, it was almost like leader of the pack beefing it. You know, like, this guy was almost dead because I saw his car, his tail end lifted off the road and like bounced twice, and he regained control in a different lane of the highway. It was ridiculous, and I thought to myself, you know, if that guy would have hit the freeway, a sign, a pedestrian, whatever, I wouldn't have helped, because that dude deserved to die.
He deserved to die, and he deserved his gravestone to read, "Died while racing a Dodge Neon, an economy car."
Well, I think the guy in the Dodge Neon is the bigger asshole, because what guy in a Dodge Neon's like, dude, I gotta, he's challenging me, I've gotta accept, you know, like, if I'm in a Dodge, look, I drive a Saturn Ion, and if any asshole wants to race me, best of luck, guy, you hit your gas pedal, I'll continue coasting and get my good gas mileage. Okay, well, before we end this, I have to do a plug, because a good friend of mine, and I've said it before, her name's Emily, she's awesome, and she plays this band called Helen. They're a local band. Anyway, they're having a benefit this Friday, and I know there's some people who listen to this podcast who are local to the Detroit area, and if you have a chance, it's at the Royal Oak Music Theater. Tickets are $22, but again, Cystic Fibrosis is the charity, the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. It's 90 cents of every dollar goes towards the charity. It's badass. These guys are always, what they're doing is, I'm trying to think, maybe I heard it wrong. I don't want to say it because I might be wrong. But anyway, she's going to be on a podcast, so I'd like to plug their podcast. It's this guy named Jerry Cahill. And I think he's got CF himself, and he does a cystic fibrosis podcast. And so he's going to interview her. I'm not sure when, but he's going to interview her on that podcast. So go to, I think it's jerrycahill.com. That's C-A-H-I-L-L. So just check that out there, because sooner or later he's going to interview her. And if you get a chance, you know, donate to Cystic Fibrosis or just come out to the show. There's going to be four bands playing, and Emily's the drummer for this band, so she's using her lungs avidly, and, you know, hopefully Cystic Fibrosis gets a cure, but if not, people still need lung transplants, and they need cash to do it. So, anyway, just thought I'd throw that in there. And right on Wagner's EP came out. Buy it. Email me. I'll send it to you. Just give me $5.
Okay.
All right, yeah, so that's it for me this week.
Peace out.
Bye.
It's just about 12, and everyone.
You have been listening to This Just In, recorded on Sunday, February 19th, 2006, and distributed on Monday, February 20th, 2006. For more information about this podcast, as well as a literary journal and blog, please visit www.the-means.com.
Forget about sins, forget about all that we have. Relearning to breathe, that hasn't changed. From the first time I saw you, you're still all that I see. Hey, relax.